Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, so I'm really looking forward to talking for the next 4.5 hours about... that's not how much time I have, is it? anyway, it is a pleasure to be here and talk about something that I've been dealing with for the last 30-odd years, a topic that all of our nations have pretty much said over and over again that it is one of the greatest concerns and the greatest threats to international security, and that is the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And so I want to lay out for you some of those concerns, talk about how we've addressed what the threat is and how we address it, and look at some of the proposed legal responses, if you will, and go through this in a fairly quick period of time. As I said, I was responsible for NATO's nuclear deterrence posture and policy while I was at NATO, and I oversaw our nuclear weapons deployment, and that's why I don't have any hair today. I'm glad you got all the lights on, Bob. And usually they have these things where it's a little bit darker, and so I always have a problem there because the light shines off the top of my head, but that doesn't appear to be a problem now. Hopefully you'll get some, a sense of the issues and problems through this presentation. And by the way, this is a topic that I actually teach a full semester on at the University of Mary Washington. So I'm going to rush through a lot of this, and hopefully we'll get to the end where we'll have an opportunity to ask a few questions, and you'll hopefully learn something from my presentation. I'm often reminded when I think about this about a preacher in Ashland, Virginia, actually, where I live now, and he was very upset about the fact that his community didn't really take the moral lessons he was trying to convey. So one Sunday at church, he brings in these three jars, and all three of them have worms in them. And he says, look, see this first one, I put whiskey in this jar, and look what happened to the worm. And the worm was lifeless, he died. Picked up the second one, he said, look, I filled this with cigarette smoke, and look what happened. You can barely see it, but there's bottom of the jar, the worm's dead. And he picked up the third jar, and it had soil in it, and you could see the worm moving around. He says, you see, I planted this worm in the soil, and he's thriving. Now, what lessons do you think you can learn from this? And a little old lady in the back raised her hand, got up and says, well, preacher, I think if you smoke and drink, you won't get worms. Now, that's not exactly what I hope you'll get out of this presentation anyway today. So I want to start and talk a little bit about the first of all, the international, because it is important, the so-called New World Security environment. And this is important because that also has an increasing aspect, if you will, about the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. During the Cold War, we really didn't think that much about non-proliferation activities because with the Cold War bipolar world was really dominated the international political scene. Now, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, those former states are a proliferation concern for us. In Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and other countries, there are thousands, as an example, of what we call orphan radioactive sources that pose a real concern that terrorists might acquire these materials and fashion a radiological bomb, or a dirty bomb, as we say, and of course, cause the kind of panic that terrorists can inflict. And by the way, when I talk about weapons of mass destruction, and that's because there is no agreed international definition of weapons of mass destruction, I'm talking about chemical, biological, nuclear type of devices and their means of delivery. Okay, so, and that's what I want to cover there. The other aspect, the interesting phenomenon that's going on, unlike 20, 30, 40 years ago, is the globalization of the marketplace, if you will, which really, in some respects, there's really no longer such thing as a third world, first world, second world, because this trade is ubiquitous. And we now see in the most remotest parts of the world technologies that could be used for developing weapons of mass destruction. And then finally, more and more in the international community, non-state actors can predominate. Just recently, I was reading the paper last month where a Mexican drug cartel had taken over a whole province in Mexico, and where they weren't necessarily selling drugs, they were into mining, they were into transporting other goods, they were doing all kinds of things that the state wasn't aware of. And so we now see international criminal organizations, terrorists, and other kind of groups that aren't necessarily related to states taking a predominant role in the international workplace and marketplace. And some of the key assumptions that I'm going to make in this presentation is, first of all, that the desire to acquire weapons of mass destruction, whether it be by so-called rogue states or non-state actors, will continue. And that will, in fact, be a prominent feature in the international community for decades to come. Secondly, though, the United States, the European Union, and actually, as a general rule, the international community is committed to the non-proliferation effort. And that's demonstrated by the many UN Security Council resolutions and, as I will discuss, the many new initiatives that have been developed over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And the recognition that those are the kinds of new mechanisms, some people call it soft power, that will allow us to rein in these WMD acquisition strategies, if you will. On the other side, on the flip side, the negative side, unless something radically changes, like, you know, for example, Russia invading Crimea. Oh, wait a minute, that already happened, didn't it? But if something happens differently, the budgets of the Western part of the world, if you want to call it that, NATO, the United States, will continue to shrink. And that will, in fact, require, in order to maintain a defensive posture, a defensive and deterrence posture, that will hopefully deter those from acquiring these capabilities. That will require us to build coalitions, to develop cooperative security relationships. And in fact, in the NATO's strategic concept of 2010, one of the key features of NATO's strategic concept is cooperative security, reaching out to partners, and we have a whole range of partners. We thought Russia was a partner, but I guess we missed on that one. But nevertheless, we do have this whole range of partners in which we decide that if we're going to go out of area or go to any place outside of Europe, we will need to build this coalition and utilize partner relationships, as we did in Afghanistan, for example, where we have Japan, Australia, and other countries that aren't, of course, members of NATO. And also, we have to recognize that, you know, this is a multifaceted world in which we have many different threats. Many of these threats, of course, weren't the kinds of threats that we thought of in the Cold War. And so that creates new challenges. Of course, probably one of the biggest ones is the cyber world. And what do we do when, you know, some nation attacks us using a cyber weapon, if you will? Ask the Estonians. They thought the Russians were their friends in 2007. Of course, they sustained one of the biggest attacks ever. I don't know why I keep talking about Russia. I got to get off that for some reason. But and, you know, again, one of the questions, obviously, is, you know, will our allies, will the United States, given the fact that we now have a policy of pivoting to Asia, what indeed will our allies in Europe and elsewhere do with regard to that? Recently, President Obama was in Europe, and he announced the $1 billion reassurance initiative. It's an initiative I won't talk about. But that initiative has been criticized on both the right and the left because for decades, but it's even more prominent now, our allies in Europe have refused to take cognizance of the fact that they have an investment in their own security. There's a political commitment within NATO to spend at least 2% of your GDP on defense. This year, almost nine countries will spend less than 1%. Although that may be changing. Only three countries have met the 2% margin. And that, when you compare the United States, that spends between 4 and 5% of GDP on defense. And so even on the left and even on the right, the administration has been criticized because we've said over and over again that Europeans need to be more for their defense, need to do more for their defense. So we have a world that is less safe, less secure, more uncertain. We have these kinds of threats in which WMD proliferation is considered one of the greatest and most challenging threats and has, of course, in many ways, the most serious consequences if indeed it does happen. And then that coupled with the continuing problem of terrorism, again, something that's going to be with us for decades, if it ever will be able to stop something like that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, and these new phenomena of energy security problems, the trends in weapons technology, failed states, which are breeding grounds for terrorism, and the proliferation of all kinds of other threats. Let's talk now about the proliferation problem with a couple of countries, in particular the most prominent ones, Iran and North Korea, and we'll get into that a little bit in more detail. I'm going to have to run through this fairly quickly because I don't want to, I want to have time for us to talk and discuss whatever issues you want to talk about, and I have a little test case I'd like to propose to you and see what your reactions are. Anyway, as far as, again, just the litany of new threats and challenges, I already mentioned this problem or phenomenon of what we'd call loose nukes, the proliferation issue of non-radioactive or orphan radioactive sources in various countries that could be fashioned into weapons, also the failure in the former Soviet Union of adequately accounting for fissile materials, that's highly enriched uranium or plutonium, that could actually be used in a nuclear device, a nuclear weapon. We have this globalization of the workplace, and where people with the know-how of being able to build these weapons can indeed sell their services to the highest bidder, and we've had cases where that's actually happened. We know for a fact that terrorists would like to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, and we recognize that there are these WMD programs out there that are being carried out in non-compliance with their international legal obligations, and some countries are doing that. And probably one of the greatest challenges is this globalized illicit trafficking network, where we have what we now call the convergence of international criminal organizations with terrorist groups. And we've seen this happen in other places, but now this has become the new business model, where terrorists will actually associate themselves with criminal organizations and will traffic in anything. I call them Walmart smugglers. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be a nuke, it could be people, it could be stolen cars, small arms, light weapons. But we now see these networks being built, and of course we are adapting policies to try to counter that. And then you've probably heard of the AQ Khan network. AQ Khan is the father of the Pakistani bomb. He's also selling his services, his technology, his know-how, and materials to the highest bidder. We don't know how many other AQ Khan networks are out there. We've never been able to interview Mr. Khan. We don't know the full extent of his network. We really didn't discover it until Libya decided to end their WMD programs, and then that's when we discovered materials that led us to Dr. Khan. But we don't know if there are other networks out there where individuals like him are doing the same thing, and that's a real challenge. Despite all the bad news, we still have built, I think, a fairly comprehensive network of non-proliferation norms, as I call it, that give us the best chance of continuing to stop and prevent proliferation. We have a whole series of treaties. We have the Biological Weapons Convention, which I think Laura Donahue might have mentioned to you last week. We have the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and we have various organizations that support those. And we have a proliferation of nuclear weapon-free zones around the world, where the vast majority of the world has chosen, instead of developing nuclear weapons, creating areas and where nuclear weapons are not introduced. These treaties really establish the legal and moral norms and help define bad guys from good guys. It helps us then say, look, acquiring chemical weapons or acquiring biological weapons is a bad thing. In fact, every case that I know of where a country had a chemical weapons or biological weapons program and was not a member of the treaty, none of them admitted they had those programs. Syria, for example, continued to refuse all the way up to the moment they said they had them. And why is that? They weren't a party to the CWC. And that's because they recognize that the international norm is these are bad things. We don't want these weapons around. So those treaties are really the umbrella, if you will, of the non-proliferation norm, if you will. We also have a variety of conventions on dealing with terrorism. Again, terrorism, there's no consensus on what terrorism is, but if it is terrorism, we're against it. There are 14 conventions at least, plus a UN Security Council Resolution 1373 that says terrorism is a bad thing. Unfortunately, I don't know of a single terrorist group that signed any of these conventions. They haven't yet, so we'll have to keep working on that. We have a whole series of bilateral arms control agreements that, again, in compliance with our Article 6 obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which is to negotiate in good faith eventual complete disarmament, but focusing on nuclear weapons, we have this process between Russia and the United States of limiting, restricting, and reducing our strategic nuclear capabilities with a goal, eventually, as President Obama said, of eventually creating a world in which nuclear weapons no longer play a role. In addition to all of these treaties, we have a whole series of export control regimes. The Australia Group, which deals with chemical precursors, biological agents, the Nuclear Suppliers Group, the Zanger Group, which deals with nuclear materials, and the Missile Technology Control Regime, which also deals with the proliferation of missiles. And then finally, but very important, is UN Security Council Resolution 1540, which was a resolution that the Security Council passed in April of 2004 that requires states to build frameworks to ensure that their territory isn't used for development of WMD programs. Okay, you may not have realized it, but the president in 1994 declared a national emergency regarding weapons of mass destruction, the proliferation of that. That national emergency has been, this was signed by President Clinton. It was then reintroduced or re-signed by President Bush and President Obama, and it continues to be in effect today. There's been federal regulations issued along that line, but now that we have this national emergency, if you will, this gives the president a wide range of powers, of course, to deal with the phenomena of WMD proliferation. As I mentioned, NATO's strategic concept, the alliance has made it quite clear that this is considered one of the greatest threats to international peace and security. And I'm going to show you a series of statements along these lines so that there's no doubt in your mind, and there's a reason for this when we get to a little bit later in my presentation, that the international community said quite clearly that this is a threat and this is something we need to work on collectively and stop. This is just a couple days ago, or last week, the statement by the G7, which again reaffirmed that the international community wants to stop the proliferation of these weapons. This is the 2008 report on the prevention of WMD proliferation and terrorism. And again, as you see here, it's a recognition that this is a threat. It's a recognition that we need to do something about it, and that indeed this is the impetus for cooperative security in addressing these problems. Now, one of the interesting things about this particular report is, again, the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, that these technologies are ubiquitous and that we've got this globalized marketplace out there where it's fairly easy for individuals and certainly groups to acquire the technologies to develop these weapons. Back in the 90s or early 2000s, we did a project to look at how hard it would be to develop a capability to make a biological weapon. And for less than $250,000, you can buy a first-rate lab off of eBay. And all of the materials, all of the equipment is totally unregulated because it's in the secondhand market. And that was just one example of many. In fact, one of the real threats today is what we call do-it-yourself biotechnologies. We've got many, many cases of individuals making ricin and then trying to kill their spouse or do something like that But even beyond that, we've seen some of these individual groups experimenting with materials, biological materials, to use them for biological weapons. And these technologies are 20, you know, you see what's going on in high schools today, that 20 years ago you'd got a Nobel Prize in chemistry or whatever. And that's how fast these technologies are going. Mr. Firdaus here, interestingly, he was building these model airplanes, these big model airplanes. They were about 8 feet long. That carried 40 kilogram payload. And he was going to fly these things, about eight of them, into the Pentagon and several other buildings. Mr. Firdaus, unfortunately, had the very bad judgment to make his co-conspirators several FBI agents. And as a result of that, they apprehended him, and he's now doing, I think he got to 20 years in prison, for trying to develop these things. But this technology, drone technologies, in fact, I remember in 1996, a man and his son built a model airplane with a 5 kilo payload and flew it from New Hampshire to Ireland. And this was a technology in 1996. So, you know, you see all these drone technologies the United States has developed, but many other countries, many other groups are developing their own drone technologies. And just imagine, if you will, and it's pretty easy to imagine, how these technologies could be used for terroristic purposes, to include putting weapons of mass destruction in these things and flying them into a building, into a park, into an urban area, and so on. Now, how far would terrorists go? I mean, this picture for me kind of has always been gripping, and anybody that's a parent would also, I think, feel the same way. This is Hamas showing how they would outfit small children with suicide vests and create an atmosphere where this was the kind of thing that was a wonderful thing to do as a child, is to wear explosives and go into some area and blow yourself up. Certainly, one of the challenges is in this war on terrorism, if you want to call it that, is in fact having an enemy that doesn't have any constraints like we do, where we have accepted norms of behavior. And as this example here shows, they certainly don't. In Oliver Wendell Holmes, I misspelled his name, but it happened, but I think said it all about the fact that you know, there are circumstances where there is no accommodation, and that can be a real challenge. And even President Obama, in his Nobel Peace Prize speech in 2009, also made the same point that Oliver Wendell Holmes did, is certainly there are certain cases where your only recourse is indeed to use force. I have to throw in a quote from President Bush. And this is one of my favorite ones, and certainly that points out, again, the fact that technology, terrorism, support for terrorism, and the whole network is a real challenge for us. And this has been recognized in our National Military Strategy, 2011, again, recognizing that this threat is a significant one, and it certainly will have any weapon of mass destruction. I was in Washington, D.C. when the anthrax attack occurred in 2001, and it shut down the government. Now, you think about that. There's five people were killed. In fact, it was my mail facility that was hit where I worked. One of the lawyers in my office to this day refuses to open his mail. As the psychological aspect of these kind of weapons can really, really have an impact. Trying to get out of the city of Washington, it was total gridlock. How much did it cost for cleanup? It was over $1 billion just to do the cleanup of all the buildings where they detected the anthrax. The National Security Strategy of the United States, again, American people face no greater or more urgent threat than a terrorist with a nuclear weapon, and certainly any use of a weapon of mass destruction would have very, very severe consequences if and when it ever should occur in the United States. What is the threat? Well, former secretary, head of the CIA, certainly pointed out that terrorists are actively trying to acquire countries. Certain rogue nations are actively trying to acquire this capability. Interesting quote from Colin Powell when he was asked about nuclear weapons, and then juxtaposed that with the Indian chief of staff when he was asked, well, what lessons did you learn from the Persian Gulf War? And he said, don't fight the Americans without nuclear weapons. Now, why did he say that? Did he say it because America has nuclear weapons? No, he said it because no one can compete with the United States in the conventional force side. And the only way to challenge the United States is to deal with them in an asymmetrical way, which means if you have nuclear weapons, it makes it a lot easier for you to deal with the United States if you're in an adversarial relationship. But certainly there's no doubt that it was interesting, in 1998 we have these comments from Pakistan officials, and boy, guess what? That's exactly what they did. AQ Khan did it. The Pakistani government denies that they had any role to play in that. We'll probably never know for sure. But certainly with these kind of statements, one can't help but wonder. In addition, we have a very great ballistic missile threat. Over 30 nations today have ballistic missile capabilities. That, coupled with drone technologies, is very, very worrisome. Not because necessarily that it's a ballistic missile per se, but the fact that that missile most likely will have a weapon of mass destruction attached to it. Okay, let me speak a few minutes about Iran. Since the end of the Cold War, we've always been worried about Iran. In fact, there were intelligence reports that Iran, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, was offered up to $250 million for a tactical nuclear weapon. They have had a very aggressive campaign over the last 30, 40 years of acquiring the technologies and capability and wherewithal to do it. This cartoon was made in 1993. And it's still kind of relevant. Actually, it's one of my favorite cartoons. So, the Iranian nuclear program, pretty extensive. Won't go into a lot of detail, but clearly the international community, not just the United States, but as you see through a whole series of UN Security Council resolutions, International Atomic Energy Board of Governors resolutions, inspections that were allowed to take place, there is many, many, many questions about that program and very little doubt that it has a military dimension. Now, you couple that with their ballistic missile technology, it's now one of the largest in the Middle East. They've successfully placed three satellites into low Earth orbit using their own two-stage launch vehicle. They've successfully built and tested multi-stage missiles. Their arsenal of liquid and solid-fueled ballistic missiles has grown very steadily over the years. The Shahab-3 has a range of 1,300 kilometers, and that's already been deployed. They've built other variants of that, including a two-stage ballistic missile that has a range of over 2,000 kilometers. They have a new missile that they've just still testing. It's called the Simorgh, I think that's how you pronounce it, that has capability of putting a 100-kilogram satellite into a 500-kilometer orbit and could indeed have a range of in excess of 4,000 kilometers. So there's no question that, again, none of us expect that they're just going to put conventional weapons on something like that. They have a program, again, that indicates that they are looking at the ability to weaponize and put a small nuclear device on one of these ballistic missiles. Then you go on to North Korea, another one that we characterize as a rogue state, but their, of course, nuclear weapon program is well known. They've conducted three tests. It looks like right now they're getting ready to test another nuclear device. There's been numerous UN Security Council resolutions regarding their program. They are not a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention. We believe they have a very extensive chemical weapons capability. They're not a party to the Biological Weapons Convention. We believe they have a very active biological program. Obviously, they are, in many ways, a bankrupt state. They also, believe it or not, are a major exporter. One of their primary funding resources is heroin sales. And they also have connections with many international criminal organizations, and their ships that sail in many places around the world are used for the transporting of illicit materials, some of which include for their WMD programs. Yeah.
Sir, if they were to collapse or there would be some sort of coup in the country, would it be the UN that is responsible for going in and securing their stockpiles of materials, or South Korea? There's nothing.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the nightmare scenarios with South Koreans is the collapse of, I mean, that's the last thing they really want. In fact, I think they're more afraid of that than they are actually invasion, because they can't do the same thing that West Germany did with East Germany. Most likely, there would probably be some sort of international organization that would go and do that. Although, as with in the case of South Africa, when they gave up their nuclear weapons, the IAEA was there, but when the actual nuclear technology, the U.S. and I think it was France were also participants to make sure that there was no transfer of technologies that would provide information on how to build nuclear weapons. So that would be, I don't know. Simple answer is I don't know. I mean, it could be a combination of something like that, probably very similar. Now, just a note on their ballistic missile capabilities, that this is the range of missiles that they do have. The Taepodong 2 is very worrisome. I mean, that has the capability of reaching the United States. So far, their testing has not been, it has not been a very successful model, but they're still working on it. One of the biggest concerns is they would put a nuclear weapon on the top of this missile and then detonated over parts of the United States, creating an electromagnetic pulse that would destroy our electronic infrastructure. And this is a real concern because we're very, very vulnerable. In fact, the entire world is pretty vulnerable on this EMP phenomenon. Now, we've been, of course, as I showed you earlier, we've sanctioned North Korea. They are living under one of the most restrictive sanction regimes around, given their pariah status. We've urged them over and over again to engage in discussions to talk about eliminating their program. That hasn't worked very well. And they've been very obstinate in their resistance to the sanctions. This just shows you the range of these particular missiles. Again, from North Korea, a wide swath to reach both Europe as well as large parts of the United States. But like I said, they really haven't been too cooperative, as you can see. Okay, let's now look very quickly at the terrorist threat. We've had, again, many cases of terrorists, of course, committing these acts that, indeed, if they were using a weapon of mass destruction, would have been very, very serious. This Hamshin Riko, you may remember this group. This was a doomsday cult in Japan. Actually, from my standpoint, this is one of the most worrisome, because what did Hamshin Riko want to do? They wanted to destroy the world. These Islamic-based terrorist groups, they don't want to destroy the world. They want to change the world, but they're not out to completely destroy. Well, here's a group that wanted to figure out a way how they could kill everybody on the planet, and they were very well-funded. They sent missions to Africa to look at acquiring Marburg and Ebola. They sent missions to the former Soviet Union to acquire nuclear technology. And they then developed a capability to disseminate chemical and biological agents. They experimented with anthrax. They actually tried to aerosolize anthrax. Luckily, they had a bad strain, so it didn't cause any deaths. And then, of course, in 1995, they had the sarin gas attacks. Now, as I said before, there's absolutely no doubt about terrorist groups wanting to acquire this capability. And I think Spike Bowman, you had a presentation on terrorism, so we don't really need to go into that. But I'll just say that the terrorist groups you see today, their antecedents go all the way back to the 19th century. with the anarchist movement. And all the techniques, use of technology, all of the things you see today are what these anarchist groups did back in the 19th century. They're not really, there's not really very much change at all. I don't know if you've heard of Mario Buda. Any of you know who he is? When the first vehicle-borne improvised explosive device and where that happened? Well, it was in September 1920 in Wall Street. He was an anarchist, and he took 100 pounds of dynamite and a cart driven by a horse with 500 pounds of metal iron slugs and exploded it, killing over 50 people, and 400 people were injured. And we still don't have a solution for it 100 years later. So these terrorist groups, though, are very, you know, quite adamant about trying to acquire these capabilities. When you look at this spectrum, very little we can do, and of course, unfortunately, as we all know, we have this phenomena of individual, the lone gunman, getting a rifle or whatever and going into a school or a department store or a mall and shooting the place up. Very, very difficult to stop, but on a scale of damage, there's very little here. But the further we go to the right, the more damage is caused, the more effect it has on our society, and our focus is more on stopping, because we think we have a better chance at doing this, a chemical, biological, radiological, and God forbid a nuclear attack, than stopping this, which seems right now to be almost impossible. And we continue to have to work on that. But again, just a few examples of statements by terrorists stating how much they would like to acquire these capabilities. Again, bin Laden, when he was alive, said acquiring weapons for the defense of Muslims is a religious duty. If I have indeed acquired these nuclear weapons, then thank God for enabling me to do so. And then it's a religious duty for using them if I do acquire them. When we invaded Afghanistan, we found lots of documents and even experiments on trying to use various agents, various biological and chemical agents. And this guy, Rassam, a few years ago, who was arrested, he actually smuggled across the border in Canada, came down, was going to blow up Los Angeles Airport, and he had actually done research and had acquired some equipment to build a dispersion device and put it on an airplane and fly it around to disseminate anthrax. Now, I mentioned radioactive materials. Obviously, that's one of our greatest concerns about the fact that after the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, we were very concerned about their control over fissile materials, highly enriched uranium and plutonium. As I said before, there are still existing now thousands of these radioactive sources in these countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union. And there's been certainly a lot of effort to try to acquire and sell this stuff on the black market. You remember Levchenko right here? You may not. He was a former KGB agent, was poisoned with polonium-210. And died from it. Again, those are the things that those materials came from the former Soviet Union. Where all these stocks are, you see here, Russia now by far has more than any other country. Of course, we do too. We have quite a bit. Our worry was that these were not well secured. Over the last 10, 15 years, we now have higher confidence that they are. But the problem is, when we went over to Russia in the early 90s and we asked them how much they produced, they had no idea how much they produced because it was done in these closed cities and nobody was allowed to leave. And they had quotas. So if your quota was to make 20 tons of highly enriched uranium and you made your quota, that was it. Nobody worried about, you know, where it was at, because you couldn't leave the cities. Now, so, you know, we basically, when we met with the Russians and we asked them, you know, well, how much did you make? We decided to come to an agreement that it was roughly about 120 tons of plutonium and 500 tons of highly enriched uranium. That was a wild guess. And so we continue to worry about the fact that maybe there's stuff out there that are that isn't unaccounted for. And indeed, this is the most recent international or illicit trafficking database that the IAEA keeps on the trafficking, smuggling, attempted sale of fissile materials and radioactive materials. And there are hundreds and hundreds of cases where individuals try to sell these materials. Most of these cases are scams. They're not really whatever they say, but many of them are. Yes? Well, right, this was at the very, this was the end. In 93, 94, 95, Russia and former Soviet Union was going through a pretty difficult time. There was a recession. And there was not a lot of control and regulation. So hundreds of people were out there selling everything they could get their hands on. And there were a lot of attempts to sell these materials. And that's why you had that big spike during that particular period. Part of this is that the IAEA doesn't have agents out there collecting this information. It comes from the countries themselves. So we're not really sure how accurate all this is. And you know, we think it's, as we got further to the right, I think it's more accurate than it used to be. But again, we really don't know. And there could be somebody out right now in Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan actually harvesting these materials. And we have we actually have not fissile materials, but radioactive materials. We in the United States have a poor record on this as well. And of course, why is that important? Is that fissile materials, if you can get your hands on fissile material, you have the possibility of making a nuclear device. You can go on the internet and you can pretty much get 95% of all the technical know-how that you need to build a nuclear weapon. But the problem is getting your hands on plutonium and highly enriched uranium. And that's why it's so vitally important that we control those things. And it's not without the realm of possibility. The South African case, I mean, most, I still remember when South Africa announced they had six nuclear weapons. Nobody in the intelligence community had you know, forecasted that case. The best estimate was they were always 3 to 5 years away from developing a nuclear weapon. And don't forget, during apartheid, South Africa had probably the most restrictive sanctions regime going. And despite sanctions, they were still able, with about equivalent of about $2 billion in today's money, to build six nuclear weapons. I mentioned the dirty bomb, a radiological dispersion device, and any kind of radioactive material would be useful for something like this. And in this statistic, again, I mentioned earlier about the United States having a poor record as well. We've done a horrible job of keeping track of these materials. Any sort of fire alarm has americium in it. Now, very, very minute quantities. But if you bought a couple thousand of these things and went around, you could actually build yourself a radiological device. And whenever you use the word radiation, it becomes a weapon of terror. And it would have a major impact on anybody in any area. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission recently reported that they'd lost track, as I said here, of 1,500 radioactive parts since 1996. And in a couple of years ago, at Hertford, North Carolina, a significant quantity of cesium had turned up in a scrap metal plant where someone had accidentally just discarded it. And then we eventually found three other such gauges in Maryland. Now, the amount of material in that gauge of cesium, Henry Kelly, a physicist from Los Alamos, testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the cesium in the Hertford incident alone could contaminate a swath about 1 mile long, covering an area of 40 city blocks. So he said that, for example, if terrorists had taken 10 pounds of TNT and detonated a device with that amount of cesium at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., the Capitol, the Supreme Court, and the Library of Congress would exceed EPA contamination limits and might have to be abandoned for decades. The cleanup would be horribly expensive, and it would take potentially decades. There's a very good movie I actually use in my class called Dirty War. It was done by BBC, in which terrorists detonate a radiological device in the city of London. And the city of London, which is the very center of London, is one of the biggest financial centers in the world. That contamination meant that you could have no access to all of your investment records. And just imagine what that impact would be. Dirty bomb construction, the only ones I know that actually made a dirty bomb as a part of state policy is Saddam. And this is the one that they developed that you see here that could actually be used either as an artillery shell or dropped from an airplane. But we do have many cases, and the Chechens are one example, where individuals have tried to acquire radiological material and then use it as a dirty bomb, if you will. And if you want to look at what the impact is, in 1987 in Guyana, I think it's spelled G-O-I-A-N-A, Guyana, Brazil, we had a case where individuals at a junkyard found a medically discarded device that had cobalt-60 in it, took it back to their house. It was glowing green. They thought it was really neat. So they poured some of the powder in and gave it to one of their young child who put it on her face and ended up with five people dead and over 100 buildings that had to be destroyed. In fact, they had to bury the bodies in lead-lined, cement-covered sarcophagus, and over 100 buildings had to be destroyed, as I said earlier. And that's probably the biggest example of what would happen with a radiological device. And there's a pretty good short documentary of that you can find on YouTube. It's Guyana, Brazil, 1987. Again, G-O-I-A-N-A, I think is how you spell it. I'm actually going to Brazil on Friday. I got tickets to the World Cup, so. But I'm not going to Guyana. I mean, this has been such a big issue, again, securing these radioactive sources, that the Obama administration has now had three summits where they invited world leaders, 58, actually, world leaders that have attended these to come up with an international plan on how to secure these materials. And, again, it points out the very real danger that's felt. And again, we really have no control, no really understanding of how much this stuff's out there. And without accountability, the likelihood just gets greater and greater. And if you have people that are willing to wear vests with, you know, be a suicide bomber and blow themselves up with explosives, why wouldn't they use radioactive material as well? And again, that BBC movie, Dirty War, is a very good illustration of that, where individuals used and put together these bombs didn't have the protective gear that we would associate with that. Because they were willing to die for their cause. Biological weapons, again, I think Laura Donahue talked to you about biological weapons. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but just to say that from my own personal view, and I spent 4 years as the deputy head of the U.S. delegation to the Biological Warfare Convention, it is a frightening proposition. It's very difficult to beat Mother Nature, however. And so I think that's one of the reasons that we haven't really seen a major, although we've had cases of the use of biological weapons, but we haven't seen this attempt to do a massive attack with a biological agent. However, we, you know, every time something new emerges, like most recently this Middle East respiratory syndrome, people question, well, is this something new? And where did it come from? When we had a hantavirus outbreak in New Mexico, a lot of people claimed that it was an Air Force biological program. We did have a biological weapons program. It ended in 1969, and of course that's 1972 after the Biological Weapons Convention was signed, then that became the standard norm about that threat. These are the agents that have been weaponized in the past. A few others, like tularemia, and others were experimented with. Probably the most, these category agents, we call them, are the most likely ones, although theoretically, smallpox only exists in two places in the world, two facilities, one in the United States, one in Russia. If we see any case of smallpox anywhere, we know that's going to be a terrorist attack because it no longer exists in nature except for those two places. I mentioned Marburg and Ebola. We're very concerned about the some evidence we've seen of people experimenting with these hemorrhagic fevers, that it actually could be weaponized and then be used as biological agents. Again, I won't. These are just some of the impacts of those kind of agents that we've seen in the past, and obviously they would have very real major impacts. Again, the example of Washington, D.C. and the anthrax attacks, where the chaos that ensued as a result of that.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever been arrested for that? Have they solved the anthrax case?
If you ask the FBI, the answer is yes. It's one of the scientists at Fort Detrick, Mr. Ivins, was a person of interest. He unfortunately committed suicide before he could be arrested. As far as the FBI is concerned, that's the end of the case. The National Academy of Sciences disagreed with the FBI. They wrote a report saying that it probably wasn't him and it was something else. Of course, when it first happened, everyone was afraid that it was a international terrorist group or somebody else internationally. But no, so that's where it stands right now. But I think as far as U.S. government is concerned, it's closed. Chemical weapons. Chemical weapons have a long history. Of course, most obviously back to World War I, which they were used during wartime. And again, they are considered a weapon of mass destruction. Our biggest concern is not so much developing a chemical capability, but rather a terrorist, for example, using high explosives to blow up a chemical production facility and create an incident like what happened in India in Bhopal, where we had thousands of people die due to the incompetence of the people running that plant. But that's a perfect example of how you could take a facility already existence, blow it up, create a cloud of chemicals, and have that go over an urban area, and then do the damage it does. We now have an... Yes?
Do I remember correctly that there was an incident in Texas, I think, within the last about year? Not a terrorist attack.
No.
An internal fire or something along those lines, as I recall.
Yes, there was one. I can't remember exactly when. We have those things happen all the time, but... usually it's relatively isolated, and we have a small number of casualties. But, you know, after 2001, after 9/11, we did a study and recognized how vulnerable we were. For example, on the Internet, you could call up what the transportation of chemicals on our rail infrastructure. And in one case, we were able to find 12 cars of phosgene gas on a siding in downtown Pittsburgh. And you found that, now if you blew up phosgene gas, again, it was a gas used in World War I, it's heavier than air, you could kill thousands of people just by blowing up with a very small explosive devices these rail cars. Because now, and that evidence, that information was readily available on the Internet. So we've kind of eliminated those kinds of vulnerabilities, but nevertheless, our concern, again, on the panic side, you take the sarin gas attack in Tokyo, a dozen people died, but 5,000 others, actually were closer to 10,000, you know, had to be treated. Most of those people never came near that sarin gas. This was all psychosomatic. They totally overwhelmed the medical facilities in Tokyo. Because they developed these symptoms that they thought they were gassed. And that's a phenomena, again, that we see with weapons of mass destruction, with the bio and the chemical side especially, as we saw with the anthrax attacks. The psychological impact is just as great, if not greater in some cases, than the actual damage that's done. The most recent case, of course, is Syria. where we've got UN, US, and many other confirmations that indeed the Syrian government has used sarin gas on its own population. And now, of course, they're trying to eliminate that capability. All right, let's see.
Yeah. May I ask, so what about the Iraqi WMD? Do you think that it went to Syria, or that they were just pulling our chain all along?
Well, interestingly enough, in the CWC, when Iraq joined the signed the CWC and joined the OPCW, they had to make a declaration. They declared 1,200 tons of chemical weapons, artillery shells and things that they stocked. They actually had those chemical weapons. They actually did an inventory of those. So there were things that we believe went over to Syria. But the interesting aspect on the Iraqi case is that there clearly was a lot of evidence that they had a chemical weapons program. They had a nation BW program. In fact, we interviewed the lady that was in charge of that. Of course, they had, in the last closing days of the Bush administration, I think it was 400 tons of yellow cake that we shipped out of the country as part of their nuclear weapons program. But as you know, because we didn't find the smoking gun in Iraq, that is, a real program ready to go. And the chemical weapon stocks were ones that had we had been aware of, not as extensively, after the first Persian Gulf War. The UN inspectors had gone in and seen those, and they were slated for destruction. But they never got around to destroying any of that stuff, or very little of it. Interestingly enough, there were still several tons of chemical weapons in Iraq at the time. Okay, shifting just a little bit, and now, you know, I've talked about the threat, talked about all these very bad things. How do we deal with that? Well, one way we've dealt with it is our non-proliferation initiatives and our counter-proliferation initiatives. These confidence-building measures, the arms control, the treaties that I talked about, the export control regimes, all of that stuff represents our non-proliferation side. And we have non-proliferation, and we have the counter-proliferation side. Counter-proliferation, we tried to figure out, well, what is counter-proliferation and how do you differentiate from non-proliferation? And we couldn't agree, so we finally came up with this definition, which is anything the Department of Defense does is counter-proliferation. And everything everybody else does is non-proliferation. And that's kind of basically how we separate it up. But what is counter-proliferation? Unlike confidence-building measures, arms control, and all that stuff, developing strategies, tactics, capabilities to prevent the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction, to roll back the proliferation wherever it may have occurred, and deter the use of WMD, and adapt our forces to operate in those kind of environments, and then, of course, be able to do, to the extent possible, consequence management. These are our objectives, to interdict proliferation pathways, and we use a variety of tools there. One of them is something called the Proliferation Security Initiative. This is a non-legally binding initiative in which countries share information, share capabilities to try to intercept illicit trafficking of these materials. I'll talk about that more in a bit. Deterrence. Again, we'll talk about that in a minute, too. And then, of course, our defense capabilities as well. I'm going to have to run through this stuff fairly quickly. Deterrence is a very important part of our posture. Now, prior to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, of course, nuclear weapons existed. And those nuclear weapons were part of a deterrence posture that supported non-proliferation. And other countries that didn't have nuclear weapons or weren't under that nuclear umbrella, if you will, chose a different path by creating nuclear weapon-free zones, signing the NPT as non-nuclear weapon states. This deterrence posture is a combination of factors, as you see here, not only nuclear forces but conventional forces, active and passive defenses, including the ballistic missile defense capability and consequence management capability. Just briefly on NATO's deterrence posture, it's basically a recognition of the brutal, realistic fact that nuclear weapons exist. And as long as they exist, the alliance, given its history, given its background, And given the fact that it is a very strong non-proliferation initiative as well, by having a nuclear deterrence posture, have said that as long as nuclear weapons exist, they'll remain a nuclear alliance. Now, this posture is based on the threat environment. And the threat environment, since the end of the Cold War, has been pretty good. So, as a consequence, we have dramatically reduced our nuclear weapons in Europe and elsewhere, as you see in this chart, from 7,000-8,000 nuclear weapons in Europe alone down to a couple of hundred today. Since the end of the Cold War, over 90% of U.S. nuclear arms have been dismantled. In Europe, it's 97%, and they're no longer targeted at any specific target, and the preparation for getting ready to use that capability, again, based on the threat environment, is not measured in hours and days, as it used to be in the Cold War, but in weeks and months. The question then comes as well, you know, we like to go down this pathway to disarmament. You've heard President Obama talk about Global Zero. Is that feasible? Is that something that we ought to really consider? Well, first of all, the fact that we've had, since the end of the Cold War, a huge number of non-proliferation initiatives would make you think that, well, gee, since we've done all these great things, reducing the number of nuclear weapons, creating a greater environment for peace and prosperity, wouldn't that have some impact on the proliferation of these weapons? And in fact, there is no correlation. We've been able to find any correlation whatsoever from doing all these great things in non-proliferation. Instead, we've actually seen more proliferation, not less, despite, again, all these efforts at nuclear disarmament. Our deterrence posture, yeah. Sure.
One more slide. 90% of U.S. arms have been dismantled and 97% of nuclear weapons in Europe have.
Yeah.
Exactly what does that mean?
Well, 90% of U.S. strategic arms have been dismantled. In other words, from the height of the Cold War. And in Europe, we had 8,000 nuclear weapons, and 97% of those have been dismantled and withdrawn.
So,
you know, the United States had, 50,000 nuclear weapons at one point, in that range. But those included strategic and tactical nuclear weapons. In Europe, we had what we called tactical, although, again, tactical is kind of a misnomer. We keep trying to figure out what to call a nuclear weapon, because if there's any detonation of any size of nuclear weapon, that's going to be a strategic issue. But we had tactical nuclear weapons in Europe. We actually even had things like a mortar called the Davy Crockett that if you shot it, you were dead because you couldn't run away fast enough. The range was bigger than your actual capability. But we had sea mines. We had land nuclear mines. We had artillery shells. We had, of course, short-range missiles. All of that was in Europe. All of that's gone now, except for the B-61, which is a gravity nuclear bomb dropped from a F-16 or a Tornado.
So the missiles that we currently have, they're just...
We have no missiles in Europe.
Okay, in the United States, we still have...
Yes. Yes.
So what, they're at the moment, they're not pointed towards anything?
They're not targeted. In other words, there's no... back in the Cold War, we called a single integrated operation plan, a PSYOP, that actually had targeted, hundreds of targets. None of that happens anymore because we don't have any adversaries. I call it to whom it may concern deterrence.
So let's say there was a nuclear explosion in some part of the United States, and we knew somebody somehow snuck it into the United States, and
we knew who it was.
Right, and we know who it was.
Yeah.
So we would have to reprogram the missiles we have left to fire back?
It would, of course, depend on, what the president decided to do. But in most likelihood, in that kind of scenario, very likely we might use a B-2 bomber.
Okay.
you know, dropping an air-launched cruise missile. Or, you know, it's possible we might use a Trident submarine launch. It just depends on what kind of target you're looking at. I mean, if it was the old Soviet Union paradigm, where you're looking at a nation with maybe a dozens of militarily significant targets, then we might do a massive exchange. But, you know, that is very, very remote. If it's a country like Iran, where they launch one or two missiles, well, then again, it may be our decision that we would use a variety of capabilities.
Has Russia and China done the equivalent same thing, where their missiles are no longer targeted?
Well, the Russians, President Yeltsin said that they've done the same thing. Well, of course, we have no way of knowing that for sure. And of course, the Russians have dramatically reduced down. And under the New START treaty, you know, we're reducing our deployed missiles, warheads, down to 1,550, which the Russians are actually below that number right now. We're not. But that's the new level. And then the hope was that we would now negotiate further reductions as another stage. But given Russia's situation, that's all on hold. China has built up. You know, we don't know exactly how many they have. They're very opaque on their nuclear weapons program. We think they have roughly around 300 nuclear weapons, but their program continues to grow, and they continue to modernize. In fact, of the five nuclear weapon states, only the United States has not actually modernized our nuclear deterrent, and that's why it's kind of fallen apart right now, and it's one of the political issues that the administration has to deal with. So that's where we stand on that.
Thank you.
Yep, sure. Okay. Just looking at, again, the deterrence posture, this is a slide that represents the number of fatalities from wars and since the beginning of the modern state systems, going back to the Treaty of Westphalia, 1648, and approximately 2% of the world's population was victims of wars at that time. And you see this is charted out in World War I, you had a spike of about 20 million people die. World War II, about 50 million people. And then at the end of World War II, in 1945, something happened. And since that time, as a percentage of population, less than 0.5% of the world's population have been fatalities due to wars. We've not had a major power war since 1945. And you look at the literature in the late 40s and early 50s, and everybody assumed there would be a World War III. It didn't happen. And why didn't it happen? And this is the argument, although, as we know, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to prove a negative, but a case can definitely be made that nuclear weapons have been working every single day in the deterrence mission. And if it wasn't for nuclear weapons, we would have had a World War III. But that's one of these issues that can easily be debated. Missile defense, you heard a lot about missile defense, and that continues to be a major issue, certainly within NATO. Missile defense complements, it's one of those active defenses, if you will, our deterrence posture, and it is consistent with certainly our obligations, or international obligations under the Hague Code of Conduct and the Missile Technology Control Regime, which put restrictions on, well, the Hague Code of Conduct is simply a non-binding agreement among states that they would provide notifications of launches and information about missile programs. The Missile Technology Control Regime controls those technologies. One of the advantages of missile defense is you don't have to really, well, hopefully you wouldn't have to go down the path of preempting a particular adversary if you knew you could intercept their missile capability, or even further, doing a preventive attack on a capability they're building. And missile defense gives the political leaders a great deal, a wider political discretion. So if you had, for example, one launch of a missile and you had no ability to intercept that missile and it detonated on one of your capitals, I would argue that your political, your window of political choices is narrowed quite significantly, because there would obviously be calls for retaliation, all-out war, who knows. On the other hand, if you're able to intercept that missile, then you still have a greater range of options for political solutions in your confrontation with this particular nation. And so that gives us, that brings us then to these questions about this counterproliferation policy. And if you have an aggressive counterproliferation policy where you are going to preempt or prevent a WMD program, you know, what is the legal basis for doing that? You're all familiar, hopefully, with the authorization to use military force that Congress authorized the president. This is giving him this authority. This has now become controversial, and there's an effort underway to repeal this authorization. But nevertheless, given the emergency authorities of the executive order and this authorization, certainly from a domestic standpoint, I won't talk about the domestic politics and legal issues associated with the president deciding to use military force, but certainly with this particular authorization, in dealing with a terrorist attack and dealing with terrorism, and particularly terrorism with weapons of mass destruction, he has the domestic authority. James actually brought up this question about in the UN Charter, you have this whole range of legal authorities that say, hey, sovereign integrity is paramount, and you're supposed to settle your disputes peacefully. You're supposed to refrain from the threat, use of force, definitely not going to interfere in the internal affairs, and you're supposed to, you know, try to do what you can to peacefully settle all disputes. And then, of course, you have Article 51 with the inherent right of self-defense. But certainly in the 1940 Charter paradigm, the emphasis was on the sovereign rights of states and in territorial integrity and refraining from the use of force. And that, of course, goes against this, you know, very unique case. In fact, I'd argue that there are two unique cases. One is the case of what some have called the responsibility to protect. Have you heard of that phrase? Probably come up from time to time. Where, because there's a humanitarian catastrophe, the international community can override these charter restrictions and go in and fix the problem. So if there is genocide being committed in a particular country, then, you know, then you have this obligation to go in and do something about it. Well, what would happen in the case where you for example, a country contrary to the international legal norms, contrary to their international legal obligations, contrary to UN Security Council admonitions, a country is building a weapons of mass destruction program. And you know that in 3 to 5 years, they will have this capability, despite all these efforts. What should you do? Let's assume for the moment that, you know, there's no issue regarding anticipatory self-defense, this Article 51 right to self-defense, because this threat isn't imminent. This one isn't one that requires you to use force because tomorrow they're going to invade or tomorrow they're going to launch a missile against you. But you see this thing happening down the road, and you know that it's going to definitely have an impact on international peace and security, or certainly regional peace and security. So I would propose that, and this is not, doesn't have a legal basis, but I would propose that if you were going to recognize that this, what for want of a better term, is a lex specialis, that weapons of mass destruction proliferation, we've all said over and over and over again, we're not going to allow this to happen. You know, how would you deal with it? How would you go about it? How would you have a rational, common sense justification for doing that? And I would propose these six criteria. As a way of making your case for preventive military use of force to counter proliferation. Now, there's only, as you know, three cases come to mind, two of them involving Israel. One was the 1981 Israeli attack on the Osirik reactor, in which was an integral part of Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. If many have argued that if Israel hadn't have done that, the first Persian Gulf War would have been fought between two nuclear weapon states because Iraq would have had nuclear weapons. And what would the outcome of that have been? The second incident was NATO's intervention and the bombing of Serbian forces in Kosovo to prevent a humanitarian disaster. It was not done under UN sanction. And many have argued and continue to argue that it was illegal to do that. But because of this imminent humanitarian catastrophe and arguing, you know, the need to go in and make sure this doesn't happen, they did it anyway. And then the third one was Israeli attack in 2007 on the Al-Khobar nuclear facility. And that one is particularly interesting because after it happened, nobody said a word. I'd be surprised if the Syrians didn't object. The Israelis really said nothing. It all just disappeared and it was covered up, and it just as if it never happened. Okay, so just to run through this very quickly, notice would be that there's a statement saying WMD proliferation is bad. Now, I went through, what, 8, 9, 10 slides that pretty convincingly, I think, would tell anybody that, hey, you're on notice, that this is a threat to international peace and security, proliferation is bad, if you do it, you're a rogue. And all you, and again, all you have to do is look at the latest G7 statement. The threat, it's a concrete, persuasive threat. The weapon program definitely exists. You have an individual state through its behavior would be characterized as not conforming to international legal obligations, responsibilities. A force imperative that, you know, this program is at a stage that if we let it go another step further, we'll lose the opportunity. This window is the time in which we must eliminate this particular program. Discriminate response. You had a presentation on the law of armed conflict. Certainly, you know, to the extent possible, limit collateral damage. Should be a discriminate attack. Obviously, a military facility. And this would have the positive outcome that you expected that it would. That the best, again, estimate is that you would indeed degrade the ability of the proliferator to have this program or to resurrect it in any short period of time. And then finally, it's a last resort. Now, obviously, you know, what does last resort mean? How many more UN Security Council resolutions do you need to have? But again, from a common sense objective, that you've done everything you can, you've imposed sanctions, you take it to the UN, you've you know, done various other things with partners, and none of all that's worked, and they're still, you know, giving you the middle finger, and you're now faced with what do you do? Okay, now, the last thing I want to mention was the new initiatives in arms control. This is what I call the new arms control. People are getting tired of going to Geneva. I'm not, actually. It's a great place. The average time for doing an arms control treaty is 8 to 10 years. In today's globalized, fast-moving world, by the time you negotiate a treaty like that, it's already passé. You go to there, you negotiate a treaty, you have a big signing ceremony, you go to lots of cocktail parties, you gain a lot of weight. You sign this treaty, and then, of course, the bad guys promptly ignore it. Is that the kind of structure you need? We've already got in place the umbrella of what is bad behavior in this world. So what we've seen happen is, hey, look, you know, we're tired of going to Geneva, it doesn't work. Why don't we get together, roll up our sleeves, talk about a specific problem, and then a group of the willing throw some money at it, develop the capabilities, and go out and solve the problem. And that's now what we've seen happen. With the non-proliferation initiative of the early, late 80s through the 90s, and now in the 2000s. And we've had a whole series of various, very specific initiatives to stop and deal with, prevent, roll back proliferation concerns. Again, the G8 Global Partnership Against the Spread of Weapons of Mass Destruction, there was a political commitment of $20 billion by all these countries. And now I think over 80 nations have endorsed that particular initiative. Again, I don't have time to go through all these. I just want to give you a flavor of, by my last count, there's over 50 of these kinds of initiatives. Here's a whole series of more. The focus has been on regional collective grouping of nations to work together to to try to solve a particular problem in their particular region. One that I know of quite in some detail is the Black Sea Border Security Initiative, and that's an initiative where nations in the Black Sea, almost all of them, not quite, have all, you know, got together and said, hey, look, we want to work together, share intelligence, share capability, and stop the proliferation of or illicit trafficking of a whole range of different kinds of materials by international criminal groups. Of course, the Black Sea is well known. Thousands of years have been the smuggling routes to that area. So it created in Bucharest is the South European Law Enforcement Committee that is 12 nations in the area that are sharing intelligence information for all smuggling activities with a big focus on weapons of mass destruction. The Proliferation Security Initiative is probably the biggest and worldwide initiative. Over 100 countries now participate in this initiative. And again, it's sharing intelligence information on proliferation concerns. So again, I didn't have time to go through all of these aspects, but if you're going to look at it in this broader thing of proliferation prevention, all of those non-proliferation aspects, the protection side, aggressive aspects of counter-proliferation. Stuff I didn't have time to talk about is, again, having response capabilities, consequence management capabilities, so that those that used weapons of mass destruction won't achieve their political objectives, because we'll be able to deploy forces in an expedited manner to limit the damage. And all of that built on the foundation of sharing information, working together, building these international legal norms, and then having a very strong public diplomacy and strategic communications campaign.